Position number 11938, to row 44.
Mr. G. Eyston, reel 44. You'd reached Burat, Mr. Eyston, and then you said that you turned west. Where did you go from there?
Yeah, we went into the country, onto the desert again, to Wadi Zemzem. That's just outside of Gedah here. Ghedahia. Gedah here. It's about 3 miles from Gedah here, and we stopped in the Wadi. We did just 102 miles that day. When you talk of 100 miles in a convoy, it's quite a long journey, because you're controlled by the, well, we've done this before, we're controlled by the slowest vehicle. So 102 miles today doesn't seem much when we think of a journey in this country where you can do maybe 300 miles in a day. But over there, where you, for all, we've been more or less done away with any traffic, air precaution, anything like that. We were more or less nose to tail this time. But going to the desert, we'd spread out again, and we were opened out a bit. So 102 miles, it doesn't sound very much, but believe me, it was quite a good trek, especially when you're about 3 hours behind the convoy.
You were still at the back?
We're still at the back, yes. On my motorbike, this time, my three-wheeler.
Did you carry, obviously, equipment?
I had my tools, I had my toolbox. And I had a truck as well, which sort of used to travel with the MTO. And if I wanted any assistance, I'd maybe put somebody else on the motorbike and I would take the truck and do the towing.
What kind of breakdowns were you getting at this time?
Quite a lot of overeating. There's quite a lot of overeating and some fat belt troubles. There was the occasion where a set of points would go adrift, or sometimes we got filters absolutely choked, really choked up. Especially we got the cam machine coming along. I mean, when the lads have to fill up in a cam machine, you can understand that this is blowing hot sand all the time when they're filling the tank. So they're actually pouring sand in with the petrol that goes in the tank. It's that was nasty, because there's nothing you do about it. They've got to be filled up, and there were flimsies, and you had to have a fairly big funnel. We'd say the funnel's about 10 inches by 8, not quite square, it was rather longer than 8, but it's a biggish funnel, so you can see with a good wind blowing, you're getting quite a bit of sand going down the funnel. There was a water filter in the funnels when we got them originally, but I fear they've proved to be too slow, and a lot of them had the pick pushed through them, so the petrol went down a bit faster, which was oddly, in the end of the day, wasn't too bad, because it meant that we weren't getting as much sand in as it would if it was slow. But they were painfully slow to fill if with the gauze in. But of course, if we did get some petrol, on occasion we did get some cans, which had a fair amount of water in, and then we had to find a funnel with a gauze in, with a water gauze. Funny, you know, you don't think about these things for a time, because you do them so often that but they could interest somebody later on. So it does sort of explain why 102 miles is quite a long way.
Did you carry your own water for the engines with you?
On my truck, I had 240-gallon drums of water. Number of flimsy cans of petrol. By this time, we'd got away from the flimsies more or less, and we got onto the jerry can, so it was much easier in a sense. But even so, it was difficult to fill a tank underneath a body without a funnel. I had water, oil, various kinds of oil. I mean, some vehicles had as many as 7 different types of oil in, depending on the axles and the gearboxes and the engine. Could easily have 7 different types of oil, 7 different grades. The carriers used 3-4 grades, I think it was, of oil for various things. Fan belts, points, plugs, everything was petrol, of course. There was no diesels apart from what we pinched from the Italians. And they proved a bit of a problem at times, because if you had a breakdown, it was a different... you had to think differently altogether. You had to go back to the old days of apprenticeship days to deal with the diesels. That did cause us quite some problems. In fact, there was one or two left that shouldn't have been left, really. But they weren't ours. They were Italian, so we just dumped them on the way up. So that night we spent in the Waddy's Ems then, which was quite nice, just 6 miles west of Surtee. The following morning, we set off for Burr Dufane, D-U-F-F-A-N-E, and that should have been a short run to let us catch up nicely. But when we got to Dufane, we're told we're going to carry on that day to Slitten, Z-L-I-T-E-N, for the night. And the next 2 days would be running to one. Our Slitten was back on the coast road, and it was quite a nice little spot, date palms and olive palms. The Tripolitanian coastline had been well cultivated by the Italians. They had shipped quite a lot of the, I suppose in a sense they were the Italian peasants. They shifted them out, and they'd, with a lot of Italian money and cooperation and one thing or another, they'd done a good job in Tripoli anyway. But of course Tripoli was really a very old place. There's two Tripolis, one in Lebanon and there's one in Libya. But Tripoli, Cyrenaica was the home of the Cyrene, and then there was Tripoli. And then when we got into Tunis, of course, we got the Carthage. So it was an interesting place all the way along that coast. To get back where we were, going to stop at Burr Dufane that night, but we were told to carry on. And it was, as I say, quite interesting. The houses had gardens, and some with high walls, like enclosed gardens, similar to the big houses that in this country.
Were you seeing many Italian people?
Yes, there were quite a few still hanging around here.
What was
there? Around Abarchi, you didn't see many of them. The houses had been left completely, and I suppose they'd gone to Tripoli, and probably whether they did escape or not, or whether they went further west, I don't know. But around this part of Tripolitania, they stopped on the land, probably thinking it was the best thing they could do. They were... we didn't have much contact with them, really, because there were still the nomads and the Arabs. It was a mixed cosmopolitan place, really. And you could get... there's always the people coming down trying to flog something. So we didn't really bother a lot with Italians, and I don't think they wanted to bother with us very much either if it comes to that. They were all right. We had no trouble with them. They'd sort of decided it was on, and they were just all right with us. But on this trip, I hadn't seen exactly where we were going to go that night. I mean, we got to Burr Dufane, and they said that you carry on, just carry on down the road. Now, I knew when it was getting dark, they must have pulled off somewhere. And I was starting to get very worried, because I thought I'd missed them, you know. I thought I was away on my own, finally rumbling on my own instead of having the battalion in front of me. Anyway, we did get along the road further, and then we did somebody waiting for us. And we got into the lager. And luckily, with the echelon fitters being in front of me by now, you see, now we've got the battalion in front with everybody, and I was Rian and Charlie. And they caught up with the urgent repairs. And it was well in the morning when I got in. There was no bivouac that night. I just collapsed beside the truck, and that was it. So that day was 110 miles. I just seemed to have got to sleep that night. We're up to the 9th of March now. And we were waking again at 5:30, Ray Valley with a bugler. And we were on the road early. Another calm chain, you know, they come and go. You can get half a day of calm chain and then it'll clear up and you might have a lovely day after that. It might be the other way on. You might have a dew in the morning, which was great. And then in the afternoon you came into the calm chain.
Did these come on you suddenly, or could you see them coming?
You could see them coming. If you were in the right position, you could see them coming. You couldn't always see them. If you were in the... In Cyrenaica, it was fairly hilly. You couldn't always see them there. But on the desert, yes, you could see it rolling up miles away, and you'd close up whatever you could and help the lads cover up, it's coming up, you know, and get themselves caught up as best they can.
Did you stop? You didn't try to travel through it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We just closed up. We closed up nose to tail, more or less, because obviously if you're in a cam machine, you can't be seen from upstairs. So, yes, you closed up as close as you could. But we're travelling now, which was all right. I mean, you can't really get lost on a road. The only snag in this part was that you couldn't move off the road for mines. It was well mined all the way through. Now, there was so much traffic on the road in this particular spot that if something broke down, I would just put somebody on the tricycle and put a truck on and put a tow rope on the broken down vehicle. And very often we would repair it on the road as we're travelling, because there was nowhere to get off the road. And if it was an engine fault, you could often just drive the bonnet off, chuck it in the back and carry on working as you went along. And that happened on quite a number of occasions.
So you literally towed a broken down vehicle with someone working on it?
Yes, sat on the wheel doing the repair very often. Sometimes we did get as far once as having three on tour. Because you see, if you stopped, there was very little space for it to get past you. And very often a wagon breaks down, it breaks down 3 foot off the curb in any... Well, there's no curb, but I mean 3 foot into the road in any case, so it doesn't leave a lot of space on the other side. And occasionally you've got the odd one coming the opposite way. For instance, you might catch a convoy that's going down for stores or something on the other side, so then there was no way past. You just hitched on and pulled them away. As we skirted Tripoli, we didn't actually go through Tripoli. We did a detour, not exactly a ring road, and went off into the desert a little bit, and then caught bits of roads here and there, and made I suppose somebody else had made the track round, really. So we skirted Tripoli, but we could see that it was really a beautiful spot, this was anyway, with the low bungalow type houses, white houses. And we crossed the railway. The railway runs, narrow gauge railway, from Homs through Tripoli to Suara. And the weather improved slightly as we were going through, so we could see the streets of houses. And we had to open out again. Then, of course, once the weather cleaned up, we had to open out. But it's a remarkable situation compared to what we'd done coming up the desert previously. There's no air at all, no air, no enemy planes in sight at all. And really, Tripoli wasn't, Sicily wasn't so far away, you know, really. But we had no trouble at all. So, really speaking, all the air precautions had gone. And we pulled up that night just outside of Tripoli at Castelbonito, just south of Tripoli, about 4 miles south of Tripoli. Was a it had been a fort, I think, at one time, and now it was just a building with a load of ground around it. Well, that day we got through 120 miles, which wasn't a bad trip at all. On the following day, the 10th, we were back on the road skirting Tripoli. A beautiful day this one was, and we got a real good view of not Tripoli itself, but the outskirts. There was every nationality you could think of here, and the Arabs were there all the way along the road with the bakshis of eggs and cigarro eggs. Eggs for cigarro. They'd take anything. They love bully beef. But they were all the way along. The Italians, as I said, we weren't too sure how they were going to go on, but we had no trouble with them at all. We just ignored them in a sense. But the CO did make the lads sort of smarten up. There was no sort of desert style riding. He had made them smarten up, and a bit like when we went through Baghdad with a rifle between the knees and all the rest of it, just to show that we were there. Got nicely through, it was absolutely packed, and we got the same situation. If anything broke down, we just put it on tow and went on. We went through Jadaba and El Agheila, and past the Marble Arch. The Marble Arch is a monument, Benito's monument. It was a bit like the Marble Arch, but much higher. Nothing around it at all, just straight road. You can see this thing in front of you for mile after mile, and the same as you get through it, mile after mile, you look back and see the damn thing. And we got over the Tunisian border, and it's the nicely inside. The south of Tunis is desert, much the same as Libya, but the coast is cultivated. As we worked our way into Tunisia, you could see that there was little becks, there was hedges came into view. That was something we hadn't seen for donkeys. There didn't seem to be hedges anywhere. But when we got into Tunisia, we did see hedges and streams, and there had been a fair amount of water, so those streams were full. And the soil seemed as though it retained water. I mean, on the desert, it more or less ran away, or it just stayed and dried out in the sun. But in Tunisia, it seemed as though it retained the water. And the people were speaking, a lot of them were French-speaking, which was a great thing as far as I was concerned, because it meant that I could really talk to them. Although Tommy has no difficulty really in any language. It's not long before he can make himself known and get what he wants, more or less.
Were they more friendly in their approach to you?
Yes. Of course, there'd been a bad incident where the British wanted the French fleet to surrender, and they refused. I just can't remember the name, Bur-el-Mir or somewhere. Anyway, the French refused to surrender their fleet, so we went in and bombarded them. And that hadn't pleased them, the French part of it, too much. All of them, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, had all been Vichy. So they were, in a sense, pro-German. Having said that, as soon as the Yanks and the British landed in Algeria, they were more or less changed sides just the crack of a whip. In a few days, they changed sides. The Yanks did lose a few. I think they lost about 4,000 in Algeria, going through fighting with the Frenchmen. But I think that was about the only trouble, really. The majority of them, I suppose they were with the occupying side, weren't they, in a sense? Just a little thing about this. I was looking it up, and these figures, I think, are about 1958 or something like that. Tripoli is a country of about 670 square miles. with a population of 880,000. Tunisia is 48,000 square miles with a population of 3 million. It's really remarkable, really. Morocco, 172,000 square miles with a 10 million population. It just sort of gives you an idea of the different types of country. For all, Tunisia has got a certain amount of desert at the bottom of it. But all three were Vichy.
Had you any idea at this stage that you were going into action shortly?
Oh, we knew we were going up for something. We didn't know what. And we did know... we'd had rumours about the Marathon Line. We had no idea what it was at that particular time. But we had rumours about Marathon, and that could possibly be the major place. Now, the carriers, you see, they'd gone straight through to Ben Gardien on transporters. And Ben Gardien was sort of the main depot for the 8th Army at that particular stage. And they were ferrying by landing barge and anywhere transport of any description that we get to go up, which made the roads even worse. And in fact, there was one place where we had to go off the road to allow the rest of the transport to get through. Because obviously, you can't send a transporter with a tank on the back way out in the desert, not in those sort of places, whereas we stood a chance of getting through. But by now, you see, we've got an urgency coming on that we weren't dawdling forward anymore. Now there's an urgency. We knew there was something on the go. When they didn't let us stop at Bir Dufain, and we rode through that night, and we rode through again the next night, and, you know, did two ops in one, we realised that there was something imminent. Didn't know when or where. At this particular time, you see, Rommel had done a... it being reinforced by a number of divisions from Sicily, and he'd attacked the Yanks and really sorted them out. In fact, I think that's something like 41,000 casualties, the Yanks, out of this episode. But the von Arnim had come across from Russia. Two Italian generals had come from Russia, and that surprised me. I didn't realise the Italians had been in Russia. But two Italian generals had come across from Russia, and they were brought troops with them, and they were taking over it, and Rommel was sort of edged out for a spell. However, he got his back in again, and he organised a full-scale attack on the full length of the line. The First Army held him pretty well, but the Yanks, it was the first time they'd really... been in fire, under fire, and I'm afraid that they dropped out. So there was a real urgency stepping in now, because if he had got out, it meant that the First time he was going to be more or less destroyed, cut off altogether.
Were you able to pick up these feelings that something was in the offing?
Well, we knew, yes, because when they start doubling your days up, you know there's something going off somewhere. And we were hearing rumours of things not being quite right with the First Army. Well, it was said that it was the First Army, because as far as we were concerned, it was the First Army. We didn't even realise the Yanks were... Well, I suppose we did know they were there, but...
Were the men themselves talking about this?
Yes, because we had radios, you see. Each company had a radio, and you could get English news on it, and... I think by this time it had been reported in Parliament that the thing from the Algerian side wasn't going as well as it might have done.
What was the feeling then as you approached your action, although you didn't quite know when and where? What was the feeling of the battalion?
I think that none of us had a great deal of faith in the Americans. Of what they were going to do. We always regarded them as loudmouth, for all we hadn't actually fought with them at this stage. There were always so much talk of what they were going to do. And there was rumours of what was happening in England with the English girls and the American Air Force men in particular. That didn't thrill anybody, I'm afraid. Not out in the desert, anyway. And, yes, there was this... There was a little bit fun and rusty against the Americans. And when we learned that it was the Americans who were suffering, we, you know, said, oh, well, what do you expect, sort of thing. Which was the wrong thing to be doing, but I'm afraid it was there. It's just...
Did you get the feeling that, in a sense, you were going to rescue that situation?
Yes, we did, because... we knew that Rommel had sort of got more or less round the back of our front line, the back of the 8th Army's front line. We knew this, and yes, we sensed by the urgency of the thing that we were to get moving. And we did. We kept the road was absolutely solid all the way up. What happened to the planes? I don't know. The Air Force must have done... Actually, the Air Force got a lot of blame for the Dunkirk situation that we never saw any. We didn't see many in Tunisia. What they did a terrific job. And as we moved forward, we could see where they'd caught up with the Germans as they were running. And we could see that they had really done a terrific job. And... you know, the lack of air support from the lack of enemy air support, it was just amazing. You couldn't believe it was the same place, because normally we'd have been 420 yards apart and all the rest of it. Here we were nose to tail on the road, creeping along something about 5-8 miles an hour. You know, it's marvellous, really. There's one thing here that, as we're getting into Tunisia, the girls were really attractive, really smart and attractive. The only thing was, they were only 12 and 14 year old. By the time they were 16 year old, they were all married women. Of course, you don't see these things because you're not talking to them directly. To find anything out, really, passing a time of day with them and so forth, but you're not. But that's the fact. There was a 12 and 14 year old, and they looked like our 18, 20 year old. And then, of course, by the time they were 16, 18, they were old married women carrying babies around.
There were no incidents with the.
No, not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of. I think we were all. We'd been on the desert so long now that it was great to see them. And I suppose maybe one or two would have liked to have drifted off. But no, I don't think there was much problem. The problem being that you didn't exactly know who was who. I mean, there could be Arabs, there could be... you could tell the French, the Tunisian people out, dark hair. All the Arabs are dark hair, but they're a different facial feature, and a slightly different colour, not too much, but a slightly different colour. So we went on through Ben Gardin, and we lagered off in an olive grove. Now that was quite a change to be lagered under trees. We generally lagered out in the open, but now there's trees and it would spread out, and it feels different somewhere when you've got a tree over your head rather than just the clear sky. I don't know how you describe it, really. There's a smell, of course. There's a different scent altogether. Although those scents on the desert, some beautiful scents on the desert. But now it's different. You're sleeping under a tree, which is much different to sleeping out in the open with just the stars above you.
What was the food situation in this long journey? Obviously, you have stages and stopping.
We were living more or less on McConaughey's, cold, because we never got into a position where we could settle down and have a meal. We were always catching up, and if we'd caught up, there was always work to be done. I think probably we were understaffed on the fitting side of it, for the distances that we're travelling. And, you know, some of our vehicles had been on the go for some many thousands of miles now, and it's not like many thousands of miles on a road, it's many thousands of miles across desert and warfare and being shot at and not fully maintained. We maintained as well as we could, but not top notch. I mean, it didn't go every week for a service or anything like that. It got a service whenever we got a chance to change the oil, or if we had sufficient oil to change the to change it.
You'd have a mixture of vehicles. Which were the most reliable?
Well, of course, we liked our Bedfords. There was only one stag with a Bedford. We could never get to run on six cylinders. We don't know why. It was something to do with the ignition system and the heat. The Chevrolet was a great tool. The Ford was pretty reliable. It was a button to work on because the points were... there were V8s, most of them, and the points were right at the front of the engine, right behind the radiator. And a lot of them, the only way you could repair any, change the points, was to take the distributor off completely and clean the points up, put them back, and then you had to have a jig so you got the timing right on the distributor, and put the distributor back complete after you'd done the repair. So there were...